that all. So build up a love on one foundation. Come let us build our love on one solid foundation.
Got to build our love on one foundation.
Or there will never be a single drop of blue. You won't have no freedom, yeah. Got to come together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah. We got to realize that we are one.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, I would say that October, once again, would be fantasy for a spell, and we will certainly have that spell this morning with Karen Lord. Next week, not as much, but stay tuned. good morning. Well, first of all, thank everybody who enabled me to be here last week, even though I was away. I was on retreat, vacation. It was really lovely, upstate New York, outside of Cooperstown on Lake Otsego, otherwise known as Lake Glimmerglass for literary people, because that's where The Last of the Mohicans and The Deerslayer and all those books actually take place. Cooperstown, James Fenimore Cooper. You know, people think of Cooperstown, they automatically think, of course, of the Baseball Hall of Fame. But there's much more. And didn't bother to go to the Hall of Fame. I passed through there 3 years ago, outside of the trophy room. Boring. Anyway. I've had a number of fabulous, wonderful interviews pre-recorded. And last week was the wonderful Nalo Hopkinson. Next week, despite starting the fundraising drive, we will have an interview with Sherry S. Tepper, one of the great writers of science fiction. She has been since, I'd say, the early 80s. And she's in her early 80s now as well, I think. Maybe a little younger than that, but, you know, not a kid. And she lives out in New Mexico on a ranch, which I believe she co-owns and works at. And so I did a phone interview. It's the kind of thing I rarely ever do. And in the past, most of them have really sucked. But the one that I did with Sherry Tepper was really good. What was not really good was the quality, audio quality of a reading that she did for us. So believe it or not, I will do the reading. We have planned that out. And we will raise money. And if you donate X amount during that show, you can get an autographed copy of The Waters Rising, Sherry Tepper's latest book. And if you tune in to... Oh, but you are tuned in now. If you tune into this show, and I mean live, not on the internet later or whatever, you can possibly win for free 2 tickets. Oh, I should announce this right now. For this Friday night, this coming Friday night, October, what's Friday? I've got the computer right over here. I ought to have it right.
I think it.
Yeah, that sounds right. October 8th, I've got the press release right here. What happens October 8th? Well, Radio City Music Hall. What's at Radio City Music Hall? It's not just The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. It's a concert. It's this amazing thing. I went last year and promoted it last year because last year, like this year, we were able to give away free tickets. And I was granted a pair, and I attended and thought, okay, seeing, you know, Fellowship of the Ring at Radio City Music Hall with a live orchestra would at least be interesting. But that's not what happened. That's not what it was. It was that you were going to a concert with, you know, there's... they call it the 21st Century Symphony Orchestra with the Brooklyn Youth Chorus and the Desoff Symphonic Chorus, vocalist Karen Lusk, Caitlin Rusk. There are about 250 performers. It is amazing, and it just fills the space with the music. And that's when I realized, oh my God, this wasn't just hype. This really is about the music. And the movie is an incidental to it. And it's like attending a major symphonic thing. Now, they've done this kind of thing also, God help us, with video games. I think that's carrying it a little bit too far. Because video games, among other things, you know, we're scored for, you know, by Howard Shore, you know, getting the you know, fabulous music. There is the, where do people work today? Well, they used to write for the Kings. Now they write for Hollywood. That's where the great symphonic music comes from today. And that is certainly what the music of The Lord of the Rings is. So, for more information, if you want to know more about how you can pay to go see it, it's at the Radio City Lothar Concert.com. I shall spell that for you. Theradio City, City, Lothar, Lord of the Rings, Lotr, right? Those in the know, those of Tolkien, have always said Lothar, and everybody knows that's Lord of the Rings concert. So, the Radio City Lothar Concert.com. And later on in this show, later on, we will take calls. We'll take a call at random and give away a pair of tickets to this event. Okay. This coming Tuesday, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, produced by meself. Oh, we've got two events this month. Both are killers. Well, one's really a killer. I'll explain that in a little while. Well, it's a fictional killer. But the first of them is just wonderful. The first of them will be this Tuesday. Shanane McGuire and Kat Valenti, Catherine and Valenti. Shanane McGuire hails from Northern California, land of rattlesnakes, rain, and the surprising number of dangerous spiders. She wrote this. Given this environment, she was either going to be a writer or a serial killer, and she chose the less physically demanding occupation, probably for the best. Shanane's first book, Rosemary and Rue, came out in 2009. Three more books have followed. I mean, yeah, I mean, in that time, three books have come out, right, since 2009. That's under her own name. And then under the name Mira Grant as Reed, she is this year's winner of the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. Earlier this year we had on Mary Robinette Cowell, who has turned over the official tiara. Catherine Valenti is the author of over a dozen works of fiction and poetry, including Palimpsest, the Orphan's Tale series, and the crowd-funded phenomenon, The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making, which won... not the Andre Norton Award for Best Young People's Book this year. She's also won the Mythopoeic Award, the Riesling Award, the Million Writers Award, the Tiptree Award, a finalist for the World Fantasy Award twice, the Lambda, and the Hugo Award. Okay. Rose Fox is going to be our guest curator. This is a first time out for her, and I'm thrilled to have her doing something. She's one of the editors at Publishers Weekly. You know, not a minor thing. And guess what she does? Well, the science fiction, fantasy, horror. She does a lot more than that. She's also in charge of health content for About.com. She has a book coming out with Greg Benford, The Wonderful Future That Never Was, which is a book of predictions all about the future from Popular Mechanics from 1903 to 1970. I mean, that's just way cool. So anyhow, all of this and more. If you come this Tuesday, doors open at 6:30, event begins at 7, at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art at 138 Sullivan Street, Princeton, Houston, and I will be there to greet you, and Rose will be there to host, and Kat Valenti and Shanane McGuire, and by the way, Shanane is also a fabulous singer-songwriter, will be there to perform for you. More information, go to my website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Two more events happening at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. One, not science fiction involved, not involved with us, but it's a benefit. And Ord Over, the owner of the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, he's very Skiffy related. He used to be the Star Trek editor at Pocket Books. He put out all those Star Trek books for years and years. And he has, are you ready? It's a benefit for autistic children or schooling for autistic children. So what's he doing? Bacon. A bacon festival. Bacon-palooza. And I'm going, okay, is that an idea? And Margot Adler hears about this and says, oh my God, I love bacon. Yeah. So she's going to be covering for NPR. I mean, please. So with that kind of a pedigree, go to tinyurl.com/baconite, like kryptonite, but baconite, B-A-C-O-N-I-T-E, for more information about that. And I'm not going to get into it big now, but the second New York Review of Science Fiction readings event this month, October 28th, Halloween, Beyond Blackula. All black vampire writers, okay? Cherie Renee Thomas and Terrence Taylor have put together an evening that includes Linda Addison, L.A. Banks, Alaya Dawn Johnson, and Terrence is going to read from his own stuff. That's going to be so freaking cool. I can't begin to tell you. Okay. Enough with the announcements. We have a jam-packed show. Karen Lord. Her first book, Redemption in Indigo, is just out from Small Beer Press. Gavin Grant, who used to be one of the people running the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series until he moved to Northampton. Even then, he'd commute and do this with Ellen Datlow. Now Matt Kressel has taken that, and Gavin and his wife, Kelly Link, along with Jedediah Berry, run this press. And I mean, they've gotten huge coverage, even in Time magazine over it and everything. And this book, Redemption in Indigo, he sent me a copy, and I said, absolutely, I will interview this person. And, no small coincidence, I had heard that she was somehow affiliated or known to Nalo Hopkinson. Well, last week was Nalo Week, this week is Karen Lord. You know what? It's not a short interview. I'm going to shut up and play it. So that's it. Later on, we are going to be doing that ticket giveaway. But for now, this interview was recorded a little under a month ago. And Karen is back in Barbados at this point. But here on our airwaves, please do enjoy. It is September 13th of 2010, and we are at the studios of WBAI, and I am Jim Freund, and Karen is Karen Lord, who has a new book out called Redemption in Indigo, which I will characterize as being fantastic in every sense of the word.
Why, thank you.
And I am going to interrupt this to tell you, by the way, we had already recorded 10, rather, we hadn't recorded, we had already talked for 10 minutes into the interview, only to discover that we weren't recording. So what you are hearing will refer to things that had already been said that, in fact, you won't ever having heard been said because, well, they were in an alternate universe in which we were recording. And we were... the first question was, and we're going to repeat it, is... So tell us a bit about you. Yourself. Oh, and first let me start again by thanking Gavin Grant, both for making this interview happen and for publishing this book from Small Beer Press, which he and Kelly Link are, and Jedediah Berry are among the people that make it happen.
Yes, absolutely. Small Beer Press is really known for finding, he likes to call it, what, slightly weird books? And I suppose that's where this falls because, yes, it's fantasy, yes, it's speculative fiction, but it comes from a folktale that had no magic in it, and I put in magic. The folktale itself is just two or three chapters, and then I expanded it. The folktale was set in Africa, it's West Africa, and I lifted it up and put it into a world that's kind of vaguely contemporary Earth, but you're never quite sure where it is. So lots of things became sort of slightly weird for that one. But I'm not actually slightly weird. I'm very mundane. I work as a researcher in social sciences usually, but I did decide to try to take fiction writing a bit more seriously, and that's how Redemption in Indigo came about. I will break down and admit that it was NaNoWriMo. It was the National Novel Writing Month that caused me to say, right, sit down, see if you can churn out 1,000, 2,000 words a day, put something together.
That's actually a lot, isn't it? 1,000 to 2,000 words a day.
It's pretty grueling. Yeah. It feels like work. It feels like work. And I needed something to build it on. I didn't have a fully fledged idea in my head. So I thought, well, there's this folk tale I remember from when I was a child, an anthology, the Collier's Junior Encyclopedias, Volume 2, Once Upon a Time. And there was this folk tale from West Africa in the sort of Senegambia, Senegal area. And it was about a woman who had a very annoying husband whose habit of gluttony caused him to get into all kinds of scrapes and difficulties and embarrassments. And rather than the happy ever after, meaning, you know, all these two get together and live forever in peace and bliss, it was all about he finally left. She got rid of him and was able to have a life that was no longer plagued by, you know, this highly embarrassing man.
And she lived happily ever after.
And she lived happily ever after. So I thought, okay, I'll write about her happily ever after. But in a way, and I guess one of the things that we might have been discussing before, not all fairy tales or folk tales really do have a happy ever after. There's always an edge. And for me, sometimes the edge is that if you have a strength, if you have a talent, and you're called upon to use it more, sometimes those ways are not very comfortable ways. So because I looked at this folk tale and I saw his character and she had this virtue of not only of patience, but a virtue which meant that she was not about to arbitrarily tear down someone's self-esteem to make herself feel good. Mm-hmm. She knew when it was all right to just not act. When it was all right to just, you know, step aside and let things go past for a bit. She might have had the power to be cruel. She might have had the power to make someone's life miserable. And she was able to restrain herself.
An amazing power.
An amazing power. And I think people overlook it. People overlook it. They think, you know, being tough and being powerful is all about causing people harm. And to have that kind of selectivity and that kind of compassion is rare. So the kind of adventure that I gave her afterwards was the adventure that said, right, supposing some people looked at how she handled the situation and said, okay, you know, that's rare for a human. We're going to give her an inhuman power. We're going to give her a power that only the undying ones should have. And then they have to take it from someone else. Mm. They take it from an undying one who has forfeited his right to it because he's been not like her. He's been using it improperly. He's been becoming more self-centered. And then it's a battle between the two of them. How is he going to get his power back? How is she going to learn to use it? Is she going to keep it? Is it going to change her or corrupt her? And yes, it's a bit more complex than a happy ever after by then.
And it's a bit more complex also than good versus evil or
precisely
or anything like that. This is really an issue that people have to deal with.
Yes. And I do not like good versus evil when the good and the evil are separated into different persons. Because I think a lot of the good versus evil is really the internal struggle, the self. So what you will really find there is a case of they're both struggling to find their better selves, if that doesn't sound too glib.
No.
Yeah.
No, it sounds excellent. I mean, ultimately, the problem is that we have to put all this stuff into words to communicate to our listeners. Mm-hmm. And you already had the problem of having this fabulous idea in your head, and you had to commit it to a book, which is a grueling process.
Yes.
And I know people out there listening think, oh, it's just writing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
No.
No, it's work.
It is work.
And then you have the issue of relating it to other people in a way that they can understand. And hopefully I have some of the vocabulary of myth and speculative fiction and small presses and all that. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what it would be like to try and describe this to well, you were just at the Brooklyn Book Fair, which, you know, unfortunately, because of the weather, wasn't huge.
Mm-hmm. Yes, unfortunately. But there were the dedicated readers out there, and we were very grateful to see them. And the panels were very well attended as well, which was excellent.
Oh, good.
Yes, yes.
And tomorrow you're doing a reading also?
At Greenlight Bookstore,
yes. Greenlight Bookstore, yeah. So that's also very
Yes, I'm looking forward to that, definitely.
Yeah. Next time, we have to get you here so you can do my reading series.
Okay.
Which is the competitor to the reading series that Davin used to do, you see.
Ah, okay.
Oh, yeah. You see, there's two reading series here. There's the KGB Fantastic Fiction series.
Oh, yes. I've heard of those.
Mm-hmm. Which Gavin used to be co-producer of, and it's now Matt Kressel and Ellen Datlow.
Mm-hmm.
And I curate the other reading series, which is the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. I promote them equally.
Okay, good. So, excellent.
Oh, yeah, because they're just way cool. I'll tell you off the air. I'm just very annoyed I won't be at KGB this month. I have somebody else who will record it. But at any rate, Gavin was one of the curators there, and every so often he would reach into my fold of people. He took a co-curator that I had to read there. So I had him read at my series. You can't do that to me.
Yeah.
You can't do that. You steal from me, I steal from – I don't steal from you. I steal you. So I made Gavin, which is great because people – Gavin's a good writer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Actually, people don't quite know that. As far as I know, the only reading he's ever done was for me. So see, that was my getting back at him.
Oh, dear.
Anyhow, why did I get off on? Oh, because you're doing the reading.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I was just having fun. I like to hear these stories of the community, the literary community here.
Yeah, and this is when Gavin lived in Brooklyn. Although God knows that even when he was living where he is now in Northampton, Massachusetts, he would commute for the readings.
Seriously? Well, how long does that take?
It's about, 4 hours each way?
Okay, that's dedication. That's dedication, yeah.
I have another word for it.
Okay.
And thank God that there are people, another word for it, enough to do that kind of a thing. Dedicated enough. Okay,
dedicated,
we'll call it dedicated
enough.
Something
you mentioned that I really wanted to expand on. You were talking about having the idea in your head, writing it down, but then getting to the point where, you have an audience out there to communicate with.
Yes.
I mentioned, I wrote the first draft in a month, but believe you me when I say the time for rewriting and editing is far longer than that. It was about a year before I had what I would have called a draft that looked as if it was approaching final. And that came about really because I was speaking to someone who did not have the, what shall we call it? You mentioned a vocabulary of myth and folklore and speculative fiction. I was fortunate enough to be able to run my first draft past a former boss, believe it or not. I used to work in Foreign Service, and the permanent secretary at the time, he also writes. He wrote a play. He asked me to look at it. I looked at it, I critiqued it, he liked the critique, and I felt as if I could call in the favor in a sense. So he looked at it and he gave it an amazing, just old breakdown, this bit works, this doesn't, not sure about this character. So I was able to rewrite it in a very, very focused kind of way. And also able to see where the stronger patterns were and to strengthen those. And I really do think sometimes the way a book emerges is in the rewrites and in the editing, almost for me more than in the actual planning of it. Because while I'm writing, all sorts of new ideas come in and kind of warp the progress. But when you're at that sort of polishing, editing, rewriting stage, that for me is where a lot of the magic is.
That's great. And that's very, very important for the – well, I'm always fascinated in the craft of the book. I'm not a writer. I write nonfiction, about computers and stuff. Now, that's a whole other talent. And I'm not bad at that, but I've never been able to write fiction.
And you've tried, or you just said
– I've tried in passing.
In passing. Okay.
Not very seriously. It can be said that I got this radio show by turning that down. And there's actually a lot of truth to that, having to do with not having gone to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop. Yes, by not learning how to write, I ended up doing radio. But having said that, it's never too late. One day I just did an interview with Sherry Tepper, and she was just about my age when she started writing.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, she was. She said she was 54 and 56. So. Mm-hmm.
But you have the life experience then, you see. Sometimes I say to people, well, okay, here's another confession. When I was at school, and people were all like, okay, what are you going to be when you grow up kind of thing? I said, well, I want to be a writer, but I want to live a little first so I have something to write about. And I'm not telling anybody who's a young writer that they've got down pens now or anything like that. But I do think that the fascinating thing is to go and live a really exciting, adventure-filled life and then say, okay, now I can sit down and, you know, write about sailing ships and put some reality into it because I've been on one. Or talk about, you know, sort of, I mean, look at, is it Jean Le Carré writing about, you know, spies and so on. You kind of contrast
after
that.
After having been in MI5 and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, there's a feeling in that that you cannot just sit down and make up off the top of your head. And you can bet that, yes, the actual craft, the actual putting together the words and the grammar and the spelling and everything in a particular way is important. But to be able to have that content, to be able to have that taste of reality that you bring to it, that's gold.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going to keep watching you because who knows, you know, you're going to end up writing something that turns into a movie about this, you know, kind of rebel radio announcer who changes the world.
There we go. There we go.
Yeah.
There was already a movie about a rebel a rebel newspaper in which I was written in as a character, and that's true. That's
really?
True. Yeah. Between
okay.
the lines. Joan Micklin Silver. She had already written the movie, but then there were some goings on here at WBAI that she looked into, and she was told. I met her for like 1 minute, but she was told about different people, and there was a character who was already in the movie,
right.
and who some of my life things became a character
already immortalized.
Oh yes.
Oh man,
in
that's good.
In my own mind, if nothing else.
Fantastic.
No, I've had enough friends who've written great stuff that have been turned into terrible films. So,
oh, I am quite petrified at the whole making film. The only film I know that, as far as I can see, was as brilliant as the book was The Princess Bride. And really, to me, that's because the person who wrote the book wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
So he was good at both because they're not transferable skills.
They're not.
I have a lot of respect for screenwriters. I'm not going to pretend, oh, you know, you just need to have the author do it. Not at all.
William Gibson has written screenplays and had movies made of screenplays of his own stories. And
yes.
they have not worked out.
Yeah.
But one never knows. There's some minor little films that nobody has ever heard of that I think are just fabulous. And speculative fiction films at that.
Yes.
Two I will recommend quickly, Cold Souls, and another one called Sita Sings the Blues, S-I-T-A.
Uh-huh.
That is an animated version of the Ramayana.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, classic Indian myth.
Yes.
As created by this one woman she's an underground cartoonist, made this entire feature-length film using music from the 1930s, 1920s, late 1920s, and all that's wonderful, wonderful movie. And do these even get a Hugo nomination or a Nebula Award? I attend the functions where these things happen, and that community, the science fiction community, has never heard of these films.
But I was going to say, are they aware? I mean, are we actually talking now about aspects of genre blending that are or niches that they're not really aware of?
Yeah.
You're talking about something that's, you know, sort of a very indie animated thing, you know, using blues and jazz music and so forth. I can really see how that would completely be missed by someone who's, you know, looking in all the usual places at all the usual suspects. You know, there are certain presses and certain, film distributors that you can count on to be producing things that you should look at because it might be something you need to nominate. But then as something like that comes quietly at the side,
Yeah.
You know, who's the one trawling all the little film festivals? And
well, although this one was actually put to the web, it's mm-hmm. actually Creative Commons. Anybody and everybody can download it and right. watch it for free mm-hmm. at SitaSingsTheBlues.com.
Okay.
It's number one. Number two, it was mm-hmm. reviewed. I heard about it, aside from a couple of friends of mine, mm-hmm. On Leonard Maltin's TV show,
mm-hmm.
where
mm-hmm.
he gave it a rave review. I learned about it on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And those people watch TV as well and probably watch some of the same shows I do.
Okay.
And the other movie, he said, wagging his finger, Cold Souls.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a very low-budget film made by this Russian-American woman from Brooklyn, but it stars Paul Giamatti, mm-hmm. who's a recognized,
oh, yes.
known actor,
mm-hmm.
who plays an actor named Paul Giamatti. We're doing that meta thing mm-hmm. there. Who, in order to get through a production of Uncle Vanya on Broadway, goes to a facility here in New York and checks his soul. Gets
wow.
his soul taken out of him and put into a storage facility
mm-hmm.
So that he can perform better, but it doesn't work. So instead, he rents a soul of a Russian poet.
Oh, wow.
And has that inserted in him, uh-huh. whereupon he gets rave reviews. He uh-huh. goes back to the place. This is only the first 15 minutes of the film, by the way, that I'm telling.
uh-huh.
And only to discover that another woman who is a soul mule, she transfers souls between mm-hmm. here and Moscow illegally by taking all the souls into her body.
Yes.
Has stolen his soul.
Wow.
So he is now soulless.
What year did this come out?
Last year.
2009. Okay. And where can I find that?
It's available on DVD.
Okay.
It's
okay.
called Cold Souls. I mean, come on. What a wonderful
that's
premise.
That's fantastic.
This
yeah.
is a wonderful movie.
mm-hmm.
And I love the humor. It's very low key.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, no fight scenes. No chase scenes. No uh-huh. nothing. Just wonderful storytelling.
Yes.
Wonderful storytelling. Is that genre or not?
I think we're ready for that, though. We're ready to sort of step away a bit from the explosions and maybe even a bit of the CGI and so on, and really just remember the good storytelling is what we come for.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and a movie like that, yes, a small independent mm-hmm. movie, is to cinema and
mm-hmm.
science fiction. If I'm using the term science fiction in its broadest term, although that is science fiction.
It is.
Is to cinema what books like Redemption and Indigo are to press, to the small press.
Mm-hmm.
Small press, undefinable, not by a best-selling, every book comes out is a New York Times bestseller, although the New York Times gave this book an excellent review.
It did.
It was just
so
bad to me, but it was still a great review.
Oh man, I was so grateful to him. Seriously, that was a generous review. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it really was.
I've got a copy of it here to take home to my father.
Oh, good, good. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, we you can use our copy machine to make a few to give out at Greenlight Bookstore tomorrow.
I didn't even think about that.
Ah.
You know, I just think, oh, you know, it's always important to keep the parents proud of you.
That's my skill set. is
uh-huh.
promoting writers, helping them figure out those little things. But tell us, you've told us a little of the book and
mm-hmm.
the myth cycle, I guess, that it came from.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you? You are Dr. Karen Lord. You're a social scientist. What does that mean?
It means that I can work with questionnaires and interviews and get information out of people. And sometimes it ends up in programs like SPSS and becomes very kind of quantified. And sometimes it's more of a qualitative thing where I would write a report saying, well, we noticed these trends and what people are discussing about this. I know your eyes are starting to glaze over already.
No. You know what I was thinking is I'm talking too much. Let this woman talk. It's what was going through my eyes at that moment. But go on.
Good dear. Anyway,
but
so,
I was going to ask, what is SPSS?
Oh, goodness. I don't even know what it stands for. But it's like a heavy-duty Excel that social scientists use, because when they do questionnaires, the questionnaires have so many options. And it allows you to crunch numbers in particular ways.
So when you say a program, you mean a computer program as opposed to like a college program?
Precisely, computer program.
Program. Okay, sorry, go on.
Yes. But my background is even more checkered than that, and I suppose I should tell you about my background. My first degree
Please.
Is in physics. My first degree, I went to University of Toronto, and I did a major in physics, a minor in astronomy, but I did a specialist in history of science and technology.
Oh my God.
Yes.
That's wonderful.
It's maybe I am weird. Yeah. Shoot. Now that I think about
it. Weird is good.
Yeah, I guess so. So yeah, I should stop pretending to be normal then. But
I would say so. I would say so. You're special in so many ways. Why should you not acknowledge that?
There you go. So that's where I started. But what with various bits of work experience, different jobs, different bits of qualifications, I went on and did a master's. Where my life took a turn, really, was that I went to do science and technology policy as a master's in Scotland, actually, in Glasgow. So I got to have a lovely chat with Gavin about Glasgow and
oh
how much I loved
God.
It. Best year of my life. I was in the OTC. And that makes a difference because when you're in a university, lots of international students, very often you end up just hanging out with other foreigners, other people from other countries, and you don't really get a grip of the culture of the place. You might get a grip of the city culture of the place, which is sometimes not even quite fully the culture of the country because it's already accommodating a bit to all these international students. But I went into the officers' training corps because I was already in the regiment at home. That's our part-time, I guess, like what you would think of as ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And they were mostly Scots because the way their military works is that as Commonwealth, I could be part of the British Army. But it wouldn't let everybody in. See, like, okay. I don't think Americans would be allowed, for example.
Right.
But so I was basically in a situation where I was thoroughly steeped in Scottish culture and pretty much had to learn to speak Scots to be understood. I tried for a while what I like to call my generic Canadian, which is probably what you're hearing now. And they kept saying, what? So I started to speak Scots so they could understand me. Yeah, sorry, I'm digressing. Best year of my life. So after that was when I ended up going into foreign affairs quite as a shock in a way because I thought you needed to have languages, politics, those kind of qualifications to get into the foreign service. But I ran into a friend of mine who was already working there and he said, no, we're looking for people from non-traditional disciplines. I said, okay. And I went in there. And in fact, the person who I first spoke to was the very same person who I later asked to review my first draft. My life is like that, very looping back on itself. And it was actually quite cool because for quite a long time, what I did was IT and diplomacy. I was very much, yes.
I'm going to keep saying, oh my God, as long as you keep coming up with these fabulous things.
Well, it was fantastic. I went to Malta. Did a sort of 10-day workshop and then followed by distance learning from at home. And it was all about how to use, from little trivial things like how to use chat rooms to be able to have conferences and so on, using computers and so forth.
I did a little of that professionally at a science museum here.
There you go.
Liberty Science Center. It was fabulous stuff.
Yes, great
stuff to do.
And it was utterly fascinating. And then I was encouraged to apply for a Chevening Scholarship. That's a British British High Commission advertising that because there's a program at Oxford called the Foreign Service Program, where they do a certificate in diplomacy, but the students are all mid-career diplomats from various countries. And I applied for the scholarship and I got it, so I ended up spending a year in Oxford. And
okay, all of you at home, my head just slipped off my arm going, oh my God, again. But I'll verbalize it. Oh my God.
Well, I mentioned Oxford because the best thing about Oxford for me is, this is going to sound weird, pubs and chapels.
Mm-hmm.
My memory of the place is of like singing in beautiful chapels and going to the Eagle and Child. And I don't need to tell you about the Eagle and Child, do I?
Not me, but the listeners out there might want to know where C.S. Lewis and Tolkien
exactly.
and W.H. Auden came from.
Well, the whole...
The Inklings.
The Inklings, yes. And you really do get that feel in Oxford. Oh, sorry, I should have said the pubs, the chapels, and the libraries. And I do mention the library as being important because there's a library that it used to be called Rhodes House Library. Unfortunately, the name now is very long and complicated and something to do with Commonwealth or something. I can't remember. It changed since I left, so that's why it's not stuck in my head. But the point of the Rhodes House Library is that when I was writing the book, I said, I need to find the original because what I'm reading is a translation. And I need to find the original and see the ways in which this person has changed it because I don't want to tell his story. I want to try and get back at the original story and see what that had to say. So by the time I left Oxford, I was posted in Venezuela for a while. When I quit the Foreign Service to start my PhD, and as I was working on my PhD in Wales, I took a trip down to Oxford because I was doing research at various libraries anyway. So I took a trip down to Oxford, went into Rhodes House Library, found the original folktale that was The Core of Redemption, Indigo, because I was still tweaking it all the time. And it was Leo Frobenius, a German. He traveled and he basically collected folktales. He was not an anthropologist. He was an ethnologist, I think this is the term that they use. It was in German. Which actually I don't know. Spanish, yes. French, yes, I can read. But German was a little more of a challenge. But I will share one thing with you.
About one word in German. That's my last name. That's okay. About
it. So you understand me perfectly. Well, I was looking, when I was expanding the story, you get a folktale. The characters tend to be two-dimensional because it's short, because sometimes it's more about the symbol or the moral or whatever.
Yeah.
So I found myself having to try to find ways to make the three-dimensional. And of course, I was like, well, why is Ansige behaving like this? So I hope I don't spoil the story too much, but that's why I made up this story about how, you know, he was actually really the son of some chief who didn't acknowledge him. So he was like this illegitimate child in a society that put a lot of stock in being able to say who your parents are and so forth. And it made him crave recognition in ways that, you know, because that refrain, you know, don't act as if you didn't know me, you know, that very much calls out for, you know, somebody giving you attention all the time. And then I read the German and I saw enough to understand. And Sige was a bastard and had the character of a bastard. I was like, wow. I called it.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa. So anyway, I managed to, you know, with help of people who did know German and Google Translate and whatever, pick apart the original. And
what was his source?
Was he literally went traveling through the thing, talking to people who had the oral tradition.
He got it from the oral tradition.
But that's why I do say to people when they're like, oh, you've written an African folk tale, I kind of go, whoa. I'm a Caribbean person. I found it through an English translator done by an American author who got it from a German ethnologist, and we got to trust that he actually understood what he was listening to. So it's
can
all,
we get more multicultural than that?
There you go. So, I mean, in terms of the three degrees of
published
of,
by a Scottish-American.
There you go. So I can't lay claim to any kind of close intimacy. There is a sort of an emotional connection because West African culture is the culture that is sort of at the bedrock of the Afro-Caribbean experience.
Mm-hmm.
But in the sense of this isn't a folk tale that my mother told me, this isn't something that was in my schools. No, it wasn't like that. It was very much stumbling across it in this book that was really an American published book, tracing it back and discovering the German origins back in what, 1870 something or so.
Is this a living folk tale? Do people, is there a culture that tells this story?
I have no idea, because when he collected it back in, as I said, the late 1800s, it's one story amongst many. I mean, he also wrote volumes. If you want to write another book, go back and check his. I mean, there are more folk tales than there can be expanded on. So there's nothing that actually says more about who exactly the people were. You know, even the region. I don't even think the region has the same name anymore. There's just so much that was so vague. I tried to research it, and I realized, you know, this requires a depth and an amount of time investment that I simply can't put into it.
Right.
I'm just happy that the story is what it is, mm-hmm. and it looks like it can go somewhere. And I've already put it that it's not an African setting. It's a fantastical That's right. setting. That's why I like fantasy. Fantasy allows you to get away with things. Whenever you should always research your books well. I always believe that. And you should always treat cultures with a certain amount of respect, because I come from a culture which gets misrepresented regularly.
Yes.
And misrepresenting a culture means that someone from that culture has to bear the consequences, because I've also had to deal with consequences of people having certain impressions of Barbados and the West Indies and what we're supposed to be like and what they should expect when they come to visit it. So I do feel when you're writing, there's a sense of, you know, you want to be respectful, you want to do a certain base level of research. But ultimately, I do fall back on, I'm making this up, okay? Yeah. I'm making this up, and a lot of what you see in here is just me filling in huge blanks, you know, putting it in a completely different setting. Inspired by Tolkien was inspired by Icelandic sagas and you know, Celtic
myths.
Yes,
I picked up on that a little. I picked up on a little of the not necessarily the Nibelungen Lied, but still the traditions
mm-hmm. yes.
that take from them. Which, by the way, we may point out is where Tolkien mm-hmm. drew his inspirations
exactly.
from.
And there again, he could, because he had that academic background.
Yeah.
This was something he was already studying, so he was steeped in it.
At Oxford,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So,
no Oxford, no Lord of the Rings.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. So it really is a situation of there are books that are inspired by, that have the flavor of certain cultures, but do not pretend to be those cultures. And that's what I would like people to take Redemption as, very much owing to the influence of West Africa and the Caribbean, but not pretending to be either.
Right. Yeah, not at all. It really is a new place, which is the beauty and the joy of folk telling. And I think that, by the way, is how I would describe this. I mean, yes, it's speculative fiction. Yes, it's fantasy. But it is modern folk tale.
Thank you. I'm actually quite contented with that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a concept that has gone out of people's mm-hmm. thinking. But, you know, and a lot of the serious teachers of science fiction will say, well, science fiction is a mythology of the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's using the tropes of mythology, and we don't have mythology today.
Mm-hmm.
We have television, we have movies, we have all these
things. We have urban legends.
We certainly have urban legends, mm-hmm. and they are taken as fact,
mm-hmm.
which is what makes them what they are,
mm-hmm.
even though they're totally based on, people really do believe
mm-hmm.
these things. So, yeah, that I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that is true, that urban legend is this kind of a thing. The problem is that people have a tendency to... Oh, I guess this was a problem in the past as well, that they would actually apply these things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what's wrong with religion
mm-hmm.
you know, it comes from people believing the legends of their times
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and applying them in perhaps mistaken ways, even though there may be a great, wonderful ethical and moral thing underneath it.
Yes, exactly.
But the tradition of folk...
Mm-hmm.
is something that isn't recognized as folk. We don't have...
Yes.
We have singer-songwriters today. We don't have folk singers, which we had when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And even then, where are those folk... Where are the Pete Seegers and the Woody Guthries? There are a few.
I was going to say, I think there's still a few out there, but I was wondering whether the folk aspect, which to me is in a way the oral aspect, has perhaps gone into poetry.
Mm.
Where you have, you know, the poetry slams and, you know, the people going to cafes and speaking out their life and their experience, and it's done as a performance which is, you know, almost part music, part spoken word. Maybe that's where that energy has gone into.
I've never thought of that because mm. I've never quite... That's one piece of culture that I have never been able to get in on that wavelength.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it makes perfect sense.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, and it's not new in a way. I mean, isn't that what the Beat Generation was about as well?
Yes, very much so. And the Beat Generation using the sound jet of poetry, they called it, and the mm-hmm. words and all that, it really does, where they were performing in cafes with the bongo drums.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I never quite got into that either. although I have friends, and you met one, Janet Coleman, mm-hmm. who is definitely out of the Beat generation.
Okay.
No question.
Okay.
That's mm-hmm. she's written a book on the topic.
I would love for somebody to research that, because in a way there's almost a spectrum, I think, of human communication, where there's music, and music to me kind of flows into poetry, and then flows into prose. And sorry, I've forgotten a very important bit. And dance is on that spectrum as well.
Yes, it is.
But I'm going to say less about that, because that is a little beyond my ken. But I
can say it only as a spectator, but I have seen mm-hmm. such things. The one really cultural trip that I ever made in my life when I was 11 is I was in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the National Folk Dance Company. I don't recall what they were called, but the word folk dance was in mm-hmm. that.
Yes, yes.
And yes, that mm-hmm. that is a vocabulary and a tradition, and mm-hmm. it is true folk.
Yes, yes.
Although I hear, of course, in the oral tradition, I very, very much believe in the oral tradition.
Well, I'm beginning to wonder if the oral tradition needs a renaissance, because we have readings, and readings are good, but readings are not the same as telling a story. And, you know, because you've already put it down. And I know for a fact what makes Redemption different from me is that I wrote it specifically to be read aloud. I wrote it in a way that is supposed to be a storyteller who's telling it. Don't tell me you only now realize that.
Well, I heard it when I read it.
Okay. Okay.
So, yes, I picked up on that.
Okay,
but
good.
But I did not know mm-hmm. your intent. And uh-huh. we haven't gotten yet to the point where you're going to do some reading for us.
That's true.
Which we are approaching soon. Mm-hmm. But so I was sort of saving that mm-hmm. question.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have other questions which I will ask
okay.
about that. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well
but
that
yeah.
Well, that to me is a very specific way of writing, and it has helped me with readings in a sense, because there are some ways that I would write where I want the person's mind to turn it over, where they're almost forced to go back and read a paragraph several times. And you can't do that in an oral tradition. For an oral tradition, the kind of phrase you're going to write down is a phrase that's going to make its point very quickly.
It's going to
go straight into the brain, you know. It's not something for the person to ponder and to mull over. It's supposed to carry them along. So I think that along with the literary tradition, you need an oral tradition. If you want to call it an oral literary tradition, I think you can even call it that, where you're not just talking about why I call it that, literary in the sense of being, what's the expression? Highly professional, maybe? Or almost, I know, I'm running
crafted.
Into... Crafted. Crafted,
no, it's not that,
yeah.
Because, you know, oral storytelling is a craft. Recorded. In a way, because that's, to me,
uh-huh.
you start with the oral tradition. I mean,
yes.
it all started around mm-hmm. a campfire.
Yes.
It all,
yes.
you know, a few stones in a fire, mm-hmm. and from there it took off. At mm-hmm. some point, somebody said, how will somebody who wasn't here today,
right.
how are they going to get that story? That was too good not to
exactly.
preserve. And then they said, oh, we can learn how to write.
Now, you've helped me now. I've now figured it out. We'd started to write to preserve the oral tradition, but mm-hmm. we learned ways to write that celebrated the word itself. Mm-hmm. Whereas I said, the word engages the brain a certain way because you're not speaking it aloud and you can ponder a certain way. But in that sense, you then lose out the oral skill, the skill yeah. of just being able to speak it out. Now, we have it a little bit, I think, in screenplays, where dialogue has to be a certain way, but it's still not quite the same thing because there's a whole visual element that comes into screenplays and plays where, again, it's not the same as telling an oral story.
No, it's not.
Radio.
You know where I'm going. Yes.
Radio drama.
Thank you. Those were the two words I was waiting for, because that is my love.
There you go. Now, radio drama does begin, to me, to approach that oral tradition of telling the story that way.
It does. And by the way, we do better special effects.
I believe you. I believe you. Yes, yes. So I'd love to see more of that. I'd love to see more of that because I understand that.
You don't want to say that near me.
Listen, if it inspires you to go forth and do madness, do it. Seriously.
Do madness? No. I already do madness. What inspires me to say is, well, will you write the madness? That's why you don't want to say it near me. Because I entrap people.
Listen.
I say to people, you want to do that oral tradition? Well, then.
I want to learn to do that. In fact, one of the things I started doing when I was saying, should I take this writing thing seriously, was I started looking around for a screenwriting course. Because, again, different skill set. I didn't want to make any kind of assumptions. Oh, yeah, I can write a novel. I can just, you know, toss off. No, I don't believe that at all. Radio drama as well. I do think that's something that I would have to spend a little time learning and see what works. So I think so. Yeah.
And I think that today with, you know, thank God that there have been stations like ours that believe in keeping that tradition alive. But what's also happening today are podcasts, people downloading things through iTunes, audible.com, which is a part of amazon.com. They think they can make money from it.
Beautiful.
And, you know, the very revolution that has been so dependent on the printed word, you know, with thoughts of up to 140 characters at a throw, may also be the medium that will carry the radio tradition, the voice tradition of radio drama and storytelling.
Yes.
And cast it into the future.
Yes, yes. Because I know that there are big industries. We have a big publishing industry. We have a big movie industry. And perhaps that makes us think in certain boxes. And there's so many ways to tell a story. And I appreciate it. I love it when people do things where I see them combine certain methods to tell a story. And I'm like, whoa, I never thought of that. Art. Art is another thing that can do that. But again, I'm not going to discuss that too much because that's
not that, and that is another vocabulary, and one in which on radio we're not as strong with.
Absolutely. Well, you say that, but there are some kinds of oral art.
Oh, yes.
And there is a story I've written which describes a museum. And the museum is a museum to various various peoples who have died out. So there is a slab on the wall that has their names and their symbols, but there's also music playing, like the old music from the various things. There's also smells in the air, the old incense and whatever from the various rituals, and all of that's part of the museum. The museum is not just a visual experience, it's actually all the senses.
Okay, now that is fabulous. And that's the kind of writing, by the way, I expect from people like Borges.
Ah.
Who would think about that, right? Uh-huh. Who would write of museums, write about libraries? Mm-hmm. The Library of Babel is, you know, a singer and Borges and these other great, great storytellers.
Huh. Well, I like that compliment. Thank you.
And so you have recorded this story for where?
That story, well, Redemption and Indigo, one of the things that helped to launch it was that I entered it for a competition and it won. The Frank Collymore Literary Award in Barbados. It's the same person indeed who was my former boss, who saw the first draft, who after I came back from the PhD said, you know, it's on my computer. I read it again. It's really good. Even, you know, don't worry about the rejections. Send it into this competition. And I was like, oh, well, I'll get feedback. Sent it in, won, was in total shock. And from that, I actually managed to get the springboard into getting it published. And I think that...
How did you submit it? Who did you submit it to before it found its way at Small Beer Press?
I was in the UK, so I submitted it to various UK publishers. Probably a lot of it was my fault in the sense I was submitting it to the usual speculative fiction genre people. Mm-hmm. I've been told since then that... it's not straight genre, so it wouldn't have really flown with them. They wouldn't know what to do with it.
That's disappointing.
But
you see, that's the problem with the straight genre, is that it is defined. And as long as it is defined...
Yeah. Once you fall outside those boxes...
It's like, it doesn't have a space... Oh, it's fantasy. Where are the elves? Or if not the elves...
Exactly.
Where are, you know... So the moment that you create a box, the concept of fantasy is gone.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I wish more people would realize that. Yes, yes. I mean, you know, bless Tolkien, but I don't think he intended for his work to be the defining factor
No.
You know,
he'd be horrified.
Yes, pretty much.
He was trying to get a certain kind of Norse fable, you know, and he was going to tell his story of anti-technology through a Norse fable and a Teutonic myth.
Exactly.
In a retelling in modern terms, and create a Christian myth that would do all this stuff.
Yes.
The idea that, I mean, the fact that it took off is something that he was very gratified by.
Yeah.
The fact that it has become the only thing that people write is this high fantasy stuff. And then there's also sword and sorcery. Now we've defined the totality of fantasy.
Pretty much, yeah, which is scary.
As so, a genre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But thank God that there are publishers who understand that the best of the fantastic work today, and by the way, I love those things I've just described. Not so much sword and sorcery, but I love the elvish tales and all that, and I've read Lord of the Rings umpteen times, and I broadcast my rendition of Tolkien every December of the Council of Elrond.
Oh, lovely.
Which we did as a radio reading by Baird Searle's fabulous voice, and we actually called Oxford and got Professor Tolkien on the phone to tell us about pronunciations.
Whoa.
So, you know, this is like uber cool.
Yes.
So I love that stuff. And to me, it is like one point. I won't even say cornerstone because why do you want to define a corner?
This is it. Yeah.
The whole point of fantastic thinking, of speculative, let's deal with these words, speculative, imaginative, they are defined by the breadth of the imagination.
This is it, yes. And in some respects, I think fantasy suffers more than science fiction. I see more breadth and more ideas in science fiction than I see in fantasy. Though things are changing now, but I'm talking about, you know, especially those who are thinking straight genre fantasy, what they're thinking about, which is precisely what you've described. But to give you an example, Tolkien being one person you can hold in mind, Lewis is another person who I look at quite a lot. And he was again different, because even when you look at the Narnia Chronicles, that is even a little bit aside from the whole kind of, as you say, elves, dwarves and wizards thing. But what I was saying is that the story that I mentioned to you with the museum was the second book I wrote, which I also submitted to that competition, which won just up in January.
Ooh.
And that one happened because Gavin, we were emailing, dealing with redemption, and he said, well, you know, Kelly had a look at your CV and she's surprised you don't write science fiction. And I thought,
yeah, I was thinking that when you were telling me about the physics background and astronomy and all that.
So I started writing science fiction. So I wrote, it was just stories, just like writing exercises, and it turned into a series of linked stories, which then became chapters instead, which then turned into a novel.
Right.
Which I then said, okay, if I write this much, I have to do something with it. So then I did some editing, cleaning up, submitted the competition, and actually got through. But the problem with that, again, is that I have a suspicion it's not straight science fiction.
Thank God for that. And again, I love straight science fiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what's the point of science fiction if it's not going to push the boundaries?
Now, Ray Bradbury is my inspiration when it comes to science fiction.
I just finished, of course, 4 shows on Bradbury.
Well,
he turned 90 2 weeks ago.
I know. It's amazing. It's fantastic. So why I always loved Bradbury's stories is that, yes, you have Mars, yes, you have rockets, but it's always about the humanity.
Absolutely.
It's always about the human condition. And I really love that. I mean,
the fact that these people are ultimately the Martians,
you know,
is almost the definition of humanity.
Yes. And the thing
it's
about
very
it,
poetic, Bradbury. Very poetic.
Oh, you know, which is my ultimate favorite? The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit.
Oh, okay.
I absolutely love that story.
Which was done as a radio play. But just
there
that
you
I
go.
Point,
there
just
you
that
go.
I point that out.
Yes, it can be done, definitely. So basically, when you have a science fiction story where there's not a big war going on, there are no huge explosions, there's no single person with a high destiny who has to slay an evil overlord.
Oh, that word, destiny, I hate that.
Yeah, you know, small destinies are quite meaningful as well. And I prefer, I mean, in a way...
No, I don't hate the word. I hate the way it is used.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
Luke, it is your destiny.
Oh, goodness, sorry. I need to take a sip of water.
Okay, absolutely. But it's an abused word. It's an abused mm-hmm. word that lets the author cop out mm-hmm. from writing how a story is going to go. It means that they knew everything that was going to happen
yes.
to the character at the end of the story than at the beginning. And that means people don't have to live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to make decisions.
And it's making decisions that make the story. It's choices what make a story. That's the whole kind of, you know, going through the maze kind of thing. It's like, do I go left? Do I go right? What's going to change? That's what makes it all, you know, exciting to read. Sorry. You see, you're getting me fired up now.
Good. It's making great radio, I think.
Okay.
This to me mm-hmm. is the essence of what this stuff is all supposed to be about.
Mm-hmm. And I want it to be more about ordinary people because... Yes, there are some very amazing stories to be told of people who are in pivotal positions, you know, who are ruling countries or have amazing superpowers or what have you. But there can be such amazing things that happen to ordinary people that they have to deal with. I've been reading a lot of books recently where, as far as I'm concerned, they do a great disservice to their minor characters. And what I mean by that is that you've got... You know, your central protagonist, probably, you know, at least two very main people, and then a sort of a supporting, almost like the 12 disciples type group around them.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody else is almost like a prop to facilitate whatever happens with them. And the reality of life, in a way, and what to me also makes a good story, is that you can get minor characters doing some bizarre things that completely throw off the arc. You know, that, you know, even if they're just coming in for a few minutes and going back out again, they can do some amazing things. And they have lives that are apart from yours. You know, they get on and do stuff. They're not your minions. They might just decide, you know what, I'm going to go and do something else entirely. And there's a sort of an honesty in books that I read, which do appreciate that that's what a minor character can do. So it's not about characters being three-dimensional. It's about entire worlds being three-dimensional. And a world is three-dimensional when more than one or two people have...
When it's populated.
Yeah, when it's populated. When you can look at the characters and say, you know what? All of them have souls.
Hmm.
Now you're really getting me talking nonsense.
Yeah, really. Are you familiar with Mrs. Brown in the Virginia Woolf sense?
I'm not, I'm
you
afraid.
You have a treat ahead of you.
Okay.
It is an essay by the goddess known as Ursula K. Le Guin called mm-hmm. Science Fiction and Mrs. Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read it in years, but I have to. It's in her first collection of essays, which for me is just essential reading.
Mm-hmm.
I have to reread it because I've started taking it for granted.
Okay.
And she has essays from Elfland to Poughkeepsie and stuff like that, but there's one called Science Fiction and Mrs. Brown. Mrs. Brown is a very, very minor character in a Virginia Woolf piece. I don't recall which.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read much Woolf.
Mm-hmm.
But Le Guin talks about this. Our lead character, I don't remember whom, is in a railway car. And this woman comes in. They chat for a while. And for some reason or other, she bursts into tears.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation continues. And that woman is Mrs. Brown. And then Mrs. Brown leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And is not encountered again for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
She has changed the course of the book. And
yes.
She, when she leaves, our minds go with her.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
later, even though she never returns, at the end of the book we wonder, about Mrs. Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And who she is, and what the dynamics of that woman are. And Le Guin's essay, which, you know, this is like 30, 35 years ago, and hopefully this has changed, and hopefully you are part of the product of what has changed, is that Le Guin says in science fiction there is no room for Mrs. Brown.
Okay. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because the genre is so defined. It is so, and it's not just that the genre, of course, at the time was completely made male-dominated, but it is also simply the idea that it had so many set rules.
Yes.
That Mrs. Brown could not change the characters who have to fulfill a destiny. Now Le Guin doesn't talk about destiny. That's me going on. But I do feel that this is a common thing in there. And by the way, fantasy, especially sword and sorcery fantasy, and, you know, he didn't know he was a prince.
Oh, boy, yeah,
And by the way, I gobble those up. I love those.
It's a bit of wish fulfillment.
It's a male version of Ashputtel, a.k.a. Cinderella.
Yes.
You know, and that's fine. You know, we're allowed to dream of becoming princes. If Cinderella can dream of becoming a princess, why not? But that is, it's not fantasy per se. It's wish fulfillment within. It's fantasy facilitating wish fulfillment.
Yes. And.
But when all is said and done, what have we learned? We've had a nice little trip through wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
Cinderella does not really get a lesson at the end of her. Other than, yes, dear, you're special.
True, yeah. I'm going to unfortunately go back to Tolkien again.
Please.
One of the things that struck me very strongly when I read Lord of the Rings was that, and you don't get enough of it in the film, of course, but that Frodo did all that he did and was still irreversibly scarred.
Yes. You don't get enough of it in the film.
Right.
That's right. The end of the film, Sharky's End. The end of the film does not reflect the end of the novel, which is Sharky's End.
And also him, the pain he experiences on the anniversary of these significant battles that he had and the scars he still carries. And
which is why he and Sam and Bilbo and even poor Gollum, Smeagol, have to
go to the West because of that. And that, of course, references the whole World War I background that he brought into that, where, you know, when you do have a destiny and when you do go on these quests, you don't come back all happy, cheerful, happy ever after. You're haunted.
By the way, Frodo is not destined. He may be the one who
He chooses. Each time he chooses.
Which is why, by the way, the piece that we broadcast every year is the Council of Elrond.
Mm.
It is at that council
that he chooses to take it.
That everybody chooses, that people decide whether to join the fellowship. It's where the fellowship is formed, even though it cannot hold together for even another book.
Yes.
There's five books in Lord of the Rings, by the way. There are. It's five books and three appendices. The volumes that publishers have put it into is something that was outside of Tolkien's control. Tolkien wrote one novel of five books.
And now people think they have to write trilogies because they see those three books and they think that's how fantasy goes, but it's not quite like that.
Well, it's an important marketing thing.
Yeah.
And it does go that way because it sells.
True. But yeah, as you said, Frodo's choice is so powerful.
Frodo's choice,
And not only that, because, and this is what I will definitely praise at the movie for. Movies are good because they add visually what you will never be able to get out of a book just by reading. And one of the things they added visually was the look on Gandalf's face when Frodo said, "I will take the ring." It was perfectly acted. There was that expression. It was the expression of a father watching his son go off to the trenches. It really was.
And for that, we have to say praise Ian McKellen.
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
And Peter Jackson for allowing that Ian McKellen moment to come through. And I've seen him on stage, and he's
powerful.
Quite the presence.
Yes.
He's quite the presence. He's powerful beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
But what I argued The year that I broadcast the Council of Elrond's, before the movie came out, as I warned everybody, I said, this is your last chance. This is the last chance that Frodo will not look like that actor.
You're so right.
Because it is now imprinted in our mind. Before, I had many Frodos. I had the Frodo of this artist, of that artist, of the depictions that Tolkien did, because Tolkien drew a lot himself, although he almost never did the characters. Mm-hmm. He did the places, which actually are preserved very nicely in the film.
Yes.
But exactly what does Gandalf look like? Well, he looks like Ian McKellen, and he will never not look like Ian McKellen.
True.
No matter who may play the role in the near future, it will be Ian McKellen. Mm-hmm. And before that movie came out, I had my own Gandalf. Who was a closer Gandalf because I was direct to the words that Tolkien wrote, direct from him to my mind's eye. And the written word is, I will say, the second best version. The best version is the spoken word. Now, some people may reverse that. And I'll say, you know what? Okay, fine. You want to say written word is better than spoken word, be that way. That's your craft. And that's just fine. I work on radio.
Yeah, so that's where your strength is. That's where your talent is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. In presenting, not in being, but presenting and interpreting the spoken word, because I will do readings. I do readings. Although I'm the one who prefers the author's voice.
Oh, dear. Is this you?
We're getting there. We're getting there. And we can take a break first.
Okay, that'll be good.
But the author's voice is a very special voice. Most, the only other radio show that I'm aware of that presents fiction on a regular basis, Selected Shorts on National Public Radio, they have actors. Very gifted, brilliant, wonderful actors. I'm not putting down a show that reads short stories. That will not happen. I will never do that. But how many shows ask the writers to read and then get indignant? Now, we haven't even discussed the NALO issue. Ms. Hopkinson, doctor. No, she's not. Ought to be. But somebody just ought to confer a doctorate upon her. But anyway, Nalo Hopkinson auditioned to do the audiobook of I'm blanking, the robber.
Midnight Robber?
Midnight Robber, thank you. I was trying to, I was Europeanizing it, and I had the robber bridegroom in my head, which is a completely different story, the Midnight Robber, the great Caribbean, Trinidad, is it?
I'm not sure.
I think it's Trinidad. I have a story I'll tell you about Nalo and that story, and WBAI, but off the air. She auditioned to read that for the audiobook, and she was turned down. Her voice wasn't good enough. Now, have you ever heard Nalo read? It's magic. She's great. She's not good. Okay. So I produce this radio show where authors come on and read. I curate and produce the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, just as Gavin used to, and now Matt Kressel and Ellen Datlow put together the KGB reading series. The author's voice. Sometimes the authors are not as skilled as the professional actors. But at no point can you tell me that the authors are not better at conveying.
We know how it sounded in our heads.
That's right.
Yeah, that's true. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So with that note, we're going to take a break. And then we will be back shortly with Karen Lord. And this is WBAI in New York City. listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM and over at WBAI.org. And, well, you've been listening to an interview recorded September 13th with Karen Lord, author of Redemption in Indigo from Small Beer Press. And we will return to that and return to her reading very shortly. Normal, my intention when I broke there was to have some music, but we have, well, we're actually tight on time to get that whole reading in, and we do have a bit of business to take care of. And I had announced this earlier, and we have a pair of tickets to give away for next Friday night, Radio City Music Hall, October 8th at 7:30 p.m., and tickets are to The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, but it's not really that you're going to see the movie. It's that you're going to hear the score performed live by over 300 musicians. There's huge choirs and all this. I saw part one last year, Fellowship of the Ring, and I was a little skeptical, but I loved it. I really loved it. And we gave away a pair of tickets then, and we're going to be giving away a pair of tickets now. And I'm going to be starting the second part of the interview with Karen Lord shortly. And when I do, you can call us here at 212-209-2900. And I will take a phone call at random. And you have to promise me that you or your loved one will be the people to use this pair of tickets, you know. You will have to go and present ID in order to get the ticket. So, you know, there's like nothing you can put on eBay or anything like that. I'll be taking all kinds of information, and then you will prove who you are at the door, and that's how you're going to get in. So that's basically the rules, what rules there are, okay? So, having said that, imagine now that you heard a lovely piece of music, and yeah, the computer here on which we are playing this interview has been very strange. I'm going to be trying to play part two through a different player. Let's see. Ah, yes. I do believe this will work. So, again, the phone number for the chance, and by the way, calling early, being the first to call or anything like that is not going to do any good. I may just wait 45 seconds or a minute or take one immediately. It will be at random. I promise you that. So, but I will, it will be within 3 minutes of my starting it. So, so, you know, if after 3 or 4 minutes I haven't picked up and said hi to you, then no, I'm sorry, it won't have been you. So, you know, let loose whatever. And in the meantime, everybody else, please enjoy part two of this interview with the absolutely wonderful and fascinating Karen Lord. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Dr. Okay, well, when she chooses to use it at times and otherwise not. You don't really call yourself Dr. Karen Lord, do you?
Only when I'm trying to impress another researcher.
Okay, yeah. But Karen Lord, author of Redemption in Indigo from Small Beer Press and hopefully other books.
Hopefully.
and we're going to talk after. You're going to read for us, and then we're going to cap it off by asking what's coming next.
Yes, that sounds good. That sounds excellent. Well, before I read, I kind of have to give a little bit of context so that you're not completely lost as I dive into chapter 8. I mentioned before that we have the protagonist, Palma, who is a human woman who's been given a power that is wielded only by the Undying. The Undying One, who it has been taken from, is the person who I'm going to be reading about. And his, well, let's say his pseudonym for now is the Indigo Lord. he is going to try to find out where his power is. And another of his kin, who is actually a spider trickster, and I'm sure, you can't have an African folktale without having a spider trickster somewhere along the way.
You can't have a folktale without a trickster.
There you go.
And a spider trickster is one of the best.
Exactly. So he's had a conversation with the spider, and the spider has said, "Oh, well, you know, I know where this power is. You know, I don't know what your type are trying, but you know, this human has this power, and she seems to be quite a natural with it." So he's been needling him a bit, and now the Indigo Lord decides he has to go to Palma's village and find out where his power is. But he doesn't actually know it's Palma who has it. He just knows that it's somewhere there in that village. And he has to find out who, and he has to find out how to get it back. So the Indigo Lord spies on the citizens of Makenda. To walk boldly into Makenda would not be prudent. At the very least, the exercise demanded some initial reconnaissance. The Indigo Lord reluctantly decided to take up that despised practice, stealing the shadow of an insect. However, to save time and emphasize his superior ability, he took not one, but several at once, honeybees, dragonflies, and a handful of ladybirds. Shadowing multiple insects of multiple species was a pleasurable challenge, one that so occupied his mind that there was little energy left for fretting and fuming. His dragonflies patrolled the river and the wells and the ponds where the livestock were watered. The ladybirds bore the protection of superstition, for they were considered lucky, so he allowed them to settle on people's clothing and travel with them into houses where they could overhear all the latest gossip. The honeybees flew in and out of everywhere, but were often distracted by flower gardens and kitchens. He managed them all with the fine skill of an orchestral conductor, scanning the news they found for information that would help him regain his power. It became clear to him very quickly that the people of Makenda had no inkling of what was in their midst. He began to worry that perhaps the spider had, after all, sent him to scramble uselessly on a fruitless errand. Then he consoled himself. There was no way that any Jombi could sense his presence in Makenda, with his power so widely diffused into such weak shadows. Sorry, I just have to point out the name Jombi is what the Undying Ones are called in Palma's world. Also, why assume that the person who held the chaos power was indeed as proficient as the spider claimed? Chaos was a far subtler force than most people realized. It would be so easy to sense if it threw off thunderbolts or sent barely sensed thrummings through the fabric of reality, but it was nothing more than the possible made probable. It did not break or bend any laws of nature or tip the balance of the universe. How would a mere human understand how to manipulate it? They would end up thinking they were merely lucky or blessed. Finding someone who held an unused or little used focus of chaos was akin to the unenviable task of trying to find a needle in a haystack. He tried to see if there was anyone who stood out from the crowd. He looked for the village herb woman. He scrutinized the chief. He examined the local priest. They were all within the ordinary mold, with ordinary events surrounding them. Then he spied for a while on the strongest hunters, the most successful farmers, the wealthiest merchants. None of them had come by their fortunes recently and serendipitously. Finally, growing bored at last and ready to give up, he looked at the women of Makenda to see who was the most powerful matriarch. It took a bit of stretch of the imagination, but the only person who remotely stood out was Tassie. It made sense in a way. She was not a woman who stood out for her own merits, and yet her husband was prosperous enough and respected among the village elders, her daughters were of good repute, and her kitchen drew ordinary passers-by like honey draws sugar ants. As he pieced together the gossip, he became even more certain. Her older daughter had married a man considered foolish even by human standards. When he came to Makenda to see his estranged wife, bizarre accidents were the result. He'd left the village without her and with very little of his dignity. Yes, ridicule was the weapon of the quiet woman. His insects focused their attention on Tassie's household. Not only the kitchen attracted visitors. The younger daughter, who was still single, had several strings of admirers. It seemed as if Tassie was employing a very strict screening process, however. Before the suitors were given any opportunity at conversation with the object of their desire, they had to sit through a detailed interview with Tassie and her older daughter. Few made it past this first intimidating obstacle, and those who did endured the chaperoned visits for interminable weeks after that. There were compensations. The food of Tassie's kitchen was truly delightful by all accounts. However, no one had as yet gained the prize. Still, he needed confirmation. These were only hints, and he was not about to make a fool of himself for the trickster to gloat over him. Then, at last, he found it. A junior, cunningly hidden in the shadow of a child, had insinuated itself into Tassie's household. He instantly grew cautious. Sending away all but two of his shadows, he flew a bee in at the kitchen window and walked a ladybird over the threshold of the back door. "Why don't you simply show me how to use it?" murmured a woman's voice. "I would rather not even touch it," a child whispered back. His shadows were poorly positioned for a clear sight of the speakers. The jumbie was easily identified by its piping child's voice, but the voice of the other could have been either of Tassie's daughters, for all he could tell. He turned the bee and flew to the other side of the room so that he could see the faces. Splat! There was a sudden loss of aerial vision. His bee had been swatted. "Nayla, why did you do that?" "I hate bees. They look like they're waiting to sting you for no good reason." "That's wasp, Nayla. You like honey, don't you? Then let the bees live." Those two voices were almost identical. He was growing confused. Determinedly, he set his ladybird crawling up a wall for a better line of sight. When he turned it about to look down at the room, he saw the two daughters and the child's shadow. The child was looking up at his ladybird with an expression of cold suspicion, and he realized that he had spent too much time getting into position. "Would you kill that ladybird?" it said to Nayla, continuing to look meaningfully at the bright red beetle. "Don't be silly. No one would kill a ladybird. What would happen to all my luck if I did a thing like that?" A pot on the stove rattled. The older daughter was stirring the contents and examining them closely. "The syrup is ready," she announced, bringing the steaming pot to the table and setting it on a round of stone. A sheet of chilled metal was also on the table. She took out a generous dollop of syrup and handed the spoon to the child, who then carefully dribbled strings of syrup onto the cold metal. There was more confirmation if he needed it. The strings tumbled into weird spirals and highly specific knots, a sure sign of chaos if one knew what to look for. But the jombie wasn't doing it, at least not if he understood the first exchange correctly. Tassie wasn't in the room, so it wasn't her. The two sisters sat with heads close together, watching the liquid as it curled into its patterns and peeling it off when it solidified. It had to be one of them. He believed it must be the younger. A woman cautious of her luck, but contemptuous of the lives of bees, with half the men in the village and some from out of it beating down her door, yet perhaps close enough to her sister to do her the favor of ridding her of the encumbrance of a foolish husband. Yes, it was very likely. He had no idea how biased he had become. He saw Nayla's beauty, her casual cruelty, and her boredom, and he saw himself. Naturally, he believed her to be the one gifted with this stolen power. Careful not to attract attention, he let the ladybird fly away home. He no longer needed it. He felt so pleased with himself that instead of returning to conjuring the hall, he relaxed and imagined himself in a warm, sunny pasture to lie in while he plotted out the recovery of his power. There was still the problem of where the focus was located. Humans did not hold such power within themselves easily. They had a deep-seated need for symbols, talismans, and representations. Somewhere in that house was the symbol of the force of chaos, and unless he took that with him, he could not take back the power. The junior jombie would be on the alert now. It would look out for insects and guard its words from being overheard, and warn the women to guard theirs too. it would double its efforts to teach Nayla how to use her new gift effectively. He had little time if he hoped to avoid an unseemly battle with juniors and inferiors. He remembered Nayla's offhand tones after she spoke of killing the bee. She was interesting in a mundane and wholly human kind of way. Perhaps he could convince her to give up his power without a struggle. She looks like a woman who could be bribed. In fact, she looked like a woman who could be flattered. If he came to her as a suitor, with enough wealth and beauty to dazzle her, would she even notice that her power over chaos was no more when she saw all the apparent luck around her? True, it had been a while since he walked the earth in human role, but there were precedents. It might be the easiest way to get back his power. Who knows what terrible things they had said to her about him? Better that he try honey and temptation to reach his goals, rather than an attempt to use force, which might only justify any misconceptions already given. Now I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit to the actual execution of his plot to get it back from Nayla, who he thinks has the power of the stick. He goes to Makenda as a merchant prince, but he knows he can't really communicate with humans very well. So he decides to hire someone to say the words for him. And this is about this person. Alton, the poet, was a man setting out on a long journey for the first time. Because he did not look young, people assumed that he had been a long time at his job and must be something of a master. The reality was that premature graying had crowned him with an appearance of greater maturity than was actually the case. He truly was a poet, but a very young one, who was only now testing out ways to make money from his art, if art it was. A terribly shy man, he was far too self-deprecating, an unhelpful trait in any person who aims to sell snatches of empty air shaped around vowels and consonants, or worse, bits of white paper irregularly stained with black ink. When he had been hired by Beanie, he had mistaken the majordomo for the master, but when he saw who the master really was, his worries increased. Once he would have thought himself beyond fortunate to be in the household of a rich merchant prince, but fantasies and dreams worked well enough when unfulfilled. Now he would have to produce work worthy of his exalted position, and the muse in him fled in terror at the thought. On reaching Makenda, he relaxed slightly. This was the kind of village that a city man like himself rarely took seriously. It was his own fault, perhaps, that he was so lulled and vulnerable when Beanie called him into the tent office to receive his first assignment. "You are to write a love poem." Alton looked at him, expecting more, but Beanie's face was poker bland. "Just a love poem? Might I ask for whom? I mean, I don't want to be nosy, but it helps if you can imagine who you're writing to and maybe why you're writing to them. Or is this just an arbitrary love poem?" he stammered. "There is a woman named Nayla in Makenda. Her mother is Tasi, her father is Semwe, and she is not yet married. The poem is to be addressed to her, and it will be signed by our lord. Then you will deliver it to her, orally, as well as on paper." Alton flinched. His penmanship had always been excellent, but his oratory was more of a challenge. "By tomorrow," Beanie concluded. Deadlines were the one thing guaranteed to pour ice water all over Alton's creativity. He fished for help, something to delay the inevitable. "I have not even seen the subject. Where will I get my inspiration?" Beanie got up from his desk and patiently led the young man out of the tent. He pointed across the pastures towards the edge of the village, where young women were fetching water from the village well. "Go and see. Try not to get too inspired." Alton set off, trying to appear unconcerned. Women fell into that category of fantasies and dreams that worked well when unfulfilled, but presented all kinds of problems when brought into the world, real world, of trial and failure. Only his greater fear of being fired pushed him on towards the well and took his trembling legs to the edge of the group of chattering women. A few fell silent and gave him that dismissive up and down flash of the eye that women could be so horribly good at. The rest ignored him. Then one of the women turned around. It was exactly like the master poets had written it. The air seemed to turn hollow, muting the sound of chatter to mere background warbles. The other women became like so much wallpaper, a neutral background for the vividness of the central figure. He heard a voice say, "You must be Nyla. I am Alton, poet of the household of the Lord Taran." This could hardly be his own voice. It rolled, it thundered boldly. It was the voice of one who knew that he would be heard. Giddy with this unlooked-for power, he continued speaking, fueled by a rare vintage of courage. This was not Taran's doing. Taran might have done something, perhaps if the first draft of a poem had come for his signature and had proved substandard, but he had not even heard Alton speak as yet. What Alton did was not at all remarkable. Like many men before him, he had simply fallen in love with the face of the most beautiful woman in the village, and in so doing, had found his muse. There you go.
That's wonderful. That's just marvelous.
Thank you.
So to, I think we're going straight from the end of that into music, and now we're back from that music. Mm-hmm. So again, to outro that properly, that was Karen Lord reading from her new novel, Redemption in Indigo, published by Small Beer Press. And it's... You know, I can't throw enough superlatives. It is a book that you are needful of reading. It will help you. It will do stuff for you. I promise you. I don't care who you are. it's one of those books. There are often a few, and this does that for me. What are you working on now? What comes after this? I mean, obviously, you know, in genre terms, mm-hmm. you would call this an open universe.
Yes. Well, what comes next is a sequel that I'm working on. I am actually, well, I'm not going to give away the end of the book, but you've read it. And you know that there's a strong hint of other things that could come.
Absolutely.
And I'm looking...
There are a number of books. There are actually any number of places you could pick up from and go mm-hmm, to with mm-hmm. it.
So I'm actually looking a bit at one of the main characters, Returns, and it's about his journey. And it's a bit of a... There's an unfinished portion in this book. It is not... It does not appear explicitly unfinished when you look at it. It's almost a little throwaway action. Mm-hmm. But it's something that comes back in a way to haunt that original character. It was something that was not fully wrapped up. Something that was not disposed of correctly. And it begins to affect his life in very significant ways. I still have about 5 chapters to go. Mm-hmm. So it'll take a little while. And I'm trying to challenge myself. So it's going to be perhaps a little more... I was going to say a little more complicated than Redemption in Indigo, but I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to make any assumptions mm-hmm. because maybe what I will find complicated in the writing of it will actually read more smoothly than I'm thinking. So let's just say that I'm challenging myself for this, but I hope that it will be at least as good a read as the first book.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Now, given your science background.
Yes.
You alluded earlier to mm-hmm. your writing some science fiction.
Yes, I did, quite by accident. Writing exercises that turn into stories, that turn into a novel. And it's a completely different world, completely different. Mm-hmm. But kind of Bradbury-esque, ordinary people trying to live their lives in ways when they encounter extraordinary events. And that one is very episodic. It's very much each one is self-contained, although it's linked. And I have thought to myself, you know, if I ever want to really practice the screenwriting, I probably need to work on this one and see if that can turn into something that has a dramatic element to it. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find a way to get that one published. But the challenge, again, is just trying to define that genre because it is science fiction, but there's a lot of sociology in it. Mm-hmm. The world itself is based... believe it or not, on the Commonwealth in a way, where you have many different cultures, but with a sort of an overarching similarity of their legal and judicial systems and a shared history, not of being colonized by the same people, but of being influenced by the same people, of having a similar origin in some way, while still being quite different.
Colonized culturally, perhaps.
Yes, and perhaps you could say that. And then you also have a set of people who were the kind of the judges, the diplomats, the bureaucrats of the galaxy, the rulers in all but name. And they've had something terrible happen to them, where they now have to face their place in the universe as a very much a diminished force. So if my setting is like the Commonwealth, perhaps in a way these characters are almost like the British, who have lost their empire. And this is about how they deal with their new role, their new position on the pecking order, as it were. And by looking at different cultures, by looking at each episode, it becomes a bit of a road trip at some point, and they go to different places, and each place has a slightly different flavor of how they approach life. And I had some fun kind of, you know, thinking about Wales or thinking about Guyana or thinking about Trinidad and kind of weaving that into each story. But each time they're kind of challenged to see how they themselves live their life, how they define their own culture, and what they have to do to either adapt to fit into this world or to preserve what they've been losing because of this loss of empire. So it's not quite straight genre science fiction, and I'm having a bit of a challenge just trying to figure out exactly how to pitch it to people. So maybe you might see the sequel to Redemption before you see that one. I'm not quite sure yet.
Yeah, well, whatever it is, mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it. I don't know which Excellent. One I want first.
yes. But they're quite different. I will warn you about that. They're quite different. They're
good.
One is sort of like my challenging myself, pushing myself, coming to the edge. The other one is more like my happy place, my relaxed kind of comfort, cozy kind of place.
Yeah.
And maybe that will come out when you read them, yeah.
Yeah, I think it will. Well, one way or the other, it's going to be magical.
Thank you.
Whether it's science fiction or not, it is certainly fantastic and magical. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time out this trip to be here.
Well, thank you. It's been an incredible conversation. And I'm just actually glad it's recorded because I can get a copy from you.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's like posterity. No, I've had a brilliant conversation with you, and the people that you've met, the people you've interviewed, the depth of knowledge you have of this genre, you've taught me so much in this short space of time.
Aww.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I cannot say how much I learned and felt from that wonderful, wonderful interview. I hope that it came across what a great time I had interviewing Karen Lord. There was, I dare say, an immediate rapport. And I think that rapport can exist for just about anybody who reads her stuff. I truly, truly recommend Redemption in Indigo, and I like pushing it also because it's a small press. You know, Gavin Grant and Kelly Link have Small Beer Press, and well, it's actually, is it small or is it just independent now? Because they've done fairly well. A couple of the various presses that we used to just call small press. They're small in comparison to Random House or Knopf or something like that, HarperCollins. But they are not, but they're no longer like, you know, just, you know, two people necessarily. Well, actually, in the case of some of these, they are. But they're selling well, some of the books. This year's Hugo Nebula Award-winning book by Paolo Bacigalupi, who was on this program about 3 months ago, is from Nightshade Press, an independent press. But the co-winner, China Mieville for The City in the City, which I had him on the air, I guess about a year ago, talking about that book,
was a major publisher. So at any rate, Karen Lord, Redemption in Indigo, Small Beer Press, whoever the publisher, it's available at better bookstores around, brick and mortar or virtual. You have your choice. Or for that matter, you can, if you want to do virtual, you can go to ourwolf.com, a site long in need of a makeover and actually about to receive one, moving over to WordPress for that. And but nevertheless, the information there is still good. So you can go to ourwolf.com and take a look at stuff about the radio program, and you will see a link for the book, and you click on that, and you can get it that way. Also, by the way, next week, even though we are in fundraising drive, I will have an interview, again, a recorded interview, this one with Sherry Tepper, one of the great feminist writers in science fiction. She's often referred to, and rightfully so, as eco-feminist. And but that, she never lets that get in the way of good yarn, which is well, sort of a bottom line there, isn't it? Okay, this coming Tuesday, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, we have a new guest curator, Rose Fox, who's well, just a fascinating person, blogger, an editor at Publishers Weekly, and a guide on health at about.com. And Rose is going to present Shannon McGuire and Catherine M. Valenti. Kat is somebody who we get to see around, but never too often. And Shannon McGuire, well, she's here from California and doesn't make too many New York appearances, so that's way cool. 138 Sullivan Street, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art is the location. Admission is free, but we will stare you down trying to get a donation on your way in if you can afford to do so. If not, come anyway, please. It will be a good one. So, hope to see you there then. For more information on that, by the way, also you can go to ourwolf.com or follow my Twitter feeds as @JimFreund. Look it up on Facebook. We're in all kinds of virtual places. So, thank you, Karen Lord. Thank you, Gavin Grant, for having set that up. And thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. It will be fundraising time, but we will nevertheless also have content for you. So, stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Lokley. Oh, yes, Frank from Staten Island, by the way, was the recipient of the two tickets to the Two Towers. Thought I would announce that. And in the meantime, take care. Have a wonderful week. Good morning.
The time is now 7 o'clock. Time, once again, for As I Please, for this, the second day of October, in the year 10. And good morning, and hello, and welcome aboard. You are tuned to WBAI New York City, 99.5 on your FM dial. And we are broadcasting live from the bowels of New York's financial district, here on Wall Street, overlooking the East River. Well, somebody, now I feel somewhat embarrassed. I'm not exactly sure where I got this information, but since it was completely misinformation, perhaps the source is not so important. But sometime this week, somebody began talking to me about a dying language, and I was, of course, quite interested. But it was one of those occasions where my source, in this case, was an ill-informed source. And so he was unable to tell me the language, the location, or even the purpose of his telling me this. But it seemed as though he was concerned about the decline of the Gypsy language, Roma. Well, I went around, I did a little research, and then ultimately came across an item in the New York Times, and I'm happy to say that it is not the Gypsy language, but a tiny dialect in Switzerland, Romansch, R-O-M-A-N-S-H, which is disappearing fast. And, of course, the idea of halting everything to preserve a dying language, well, you have mixed feelings, you know. You say, on one hand, these people should try to keep their language alive. On the other hand, 'tis the march of time. However, I was thinking about this, and I said, you know, you've probably all seen advertisements for the Rosetta Stone, which they claim is the finest language teaching system in the universe. And you say, well, there you go. There's the answer. Take all of these dead and or dying languages and put them on Rosetta Stone to, shall we say, increase their speaking around the world. Well, that was my idea. But then I looked over a list of what Rosetta Stone offers, and they don't even offer some properly living languages like Hungarian. How are you going to learn Hungarian if Rosetta Stone isn't going to do it for you? I'm telling you. But the idea of learning dead languages through Rosetta Stone, I think, is rather amusing because, you know, Rosetta Stone sort of deals with dead languages to begin with. And you'd get your Latin and your ancient Greek and, I don't want to say Yiddish because Yiddish is a surviving language, but you get the general nub of my gist. Or so I hope. One would hate to think that after all these years, this has just been a sign of optimism on my part. And that you really have no idea what the hell I'm talking about. And if that is indeed the case, a special welcome aboard, because I don't know much more than you do when it comes right down to it. As Jim informed you, and as I will now re-inform you, next week begins fundraising here at WBAI. And at one point or another, I will be using these airwaves to ask you to support WBAI and the Pacifica Foundation, and perhaps As I Please as well. I am yet uncertain as to the schedule I will have in the upcoming fundraiser. We have sent suggestions to those in charge that it would be fit and proper for me to have a program on the 30th of October, the 125th birthday of Ezra Pound. This request sent in weeks ago. No answer yet. So stay tuned or not, as the case may be. But I do want to thank so many for showing up at the Swift on Monday night for a talk on King Lear, with a few samples from the text as well. I only really touched upon the notion of the performance of King Lear. And since I was talking about the methods of meaning to be found in Shakespeare, let me just stress once again that the collection of a number of individuals at a given time and a given place who agree to sit together in silence and listen to a play, that too is a very important element in the meaning of King Lear. Harkening back to the commonal origins of drama itself, gathering people together to listen. However, remember, reading the play is also good for you. The next Stand-Up Academy will be, as always, on the fourth Monday of the month. That will be the 25th of October. And the program will be a show for Ez. This year marks the 125th anniversary of the birth of Ezra Pound. And whatever you say about Ezra Pound, and really who doesn't, he means a good deal to me, and I really enjoy what his work makes me do, which is to think, to ponder, to learn. A very educational experience, reading Ezra Pound. And this morning will be at least one of as many as I can squeeze in this month, a program dedicated to Ezra Pound. So listen to As I Please if and when we are on the air, but do make sure to be at the Swift Monday, the 25th of October, showtime 7:30, and the program A Show for Ez. And of course, we only can hope for better weather. Well, that's nice, isn't it? And so it begins. All right, now, let's see. That was entirely on its own. A CD player decided didn't want to play the song I had queued up and had been waiting for minutes. No, it's got its own agenda. Well, I suppose that's what happens when you are at WBAI 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yes, even the CD players here have their own agenda.
The leaves of brown came tumbling down her mouth in September in the rain.
Well, 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 well. The best laid plans of mice and men. That's what happens when you count on the idea of quality here at WBAI.
Ba-da-ba-ba-da-da-da-da-da-dee-dong. Ba-ba-ba-bum-bum-bum-bum. Ba-da-da-da-da-dee-da-da. Ba-ba-ba-bum. Ba-ba-dee-dee-dee-dum-bum. Ba-ba-ba-ba-dee-dum. Every time it rains pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven? You'll find your fortune fallen all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down. Change 'em for a packet of sunshine and flowers. If you want the things you love, there's gotta be showers. So when you hear it thunder, don't run under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you and for me. Well, it's so nice to work hard and plan a program, but who knows? Who knows? Maybe a pittance of the money raised will actually be turned over to equipment here at WBAI. Aye. Well, I guess there's no help for it, you know. You plan something, it doesn't work. Move on. And so we shall. And we shall tell you that in two shakes of a dead lamb's tail.
Oh, not a dead lamb!
Well, you know, that's the way it is. In two shakes, we will be turning to special programming this morning in our beginning celebration of the birth of Ezra Pound. But before I turn to the highbrow literary crap that is a feature of As I Please, I will say that the music this morning that we will be able to play, Lord knows what will happen, by Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Monk, a master of modernism, and consequently, it seems to me, a quite good accompaniment to such American modernists as Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams. Although I should point out that Pound and Williams probably would not have recognized what Monk was doing as music at all. But what do you expect from people born in the 1880s, for crying out loud? This morning, Pound 125, Hugh Selwyn Moberly.